ever since. In addition, during the campaign, Trump spoke of, quote, fighting for peaceful regime change if elected. America is not ruled by a regime. He bloviated that he would, quote, blow out of the water the seven small Iranian boats whose sailors had harassed and given the finger to our, quote, beautiful destroyers. He bragged that, quote, Russia and I would get along really well. He suggested that maybe, quote, the Second Amendment people might be able to stop Hillary, and his supporters should patrol voting sites to ensure he was being treated fairly, and that he would love to hit and hit and hit his critics from the DNC until their heads spin and they'll never recover. He insisted that he will, quote, bomb the shit out of ISIS and order our soldiers to kill their presumed families. He repeatedly goaded supporters to rough up hecklers at his speeches and pontificated that NFL players who refused to stand for the national anthem should find another country. He quoted Mussolini's, quote, better to live one day as a lion than 100 years as a sheep. And he expressed genuine bewilderment about why we build nuclear weapons if we don't use them. In the clinical assessment of such frightening characteristics, why would Trump admire grotesque tyrants while never praising our own past presidents, but boasting that he himself could be the greatest in history, quote, except maybe Abraham Lincoln? From childhood throughout life, we all look for role models to emulate, especially when trying to navigate new and unfamiliar life challenges and transitions. We select inspirational people, often from a different time or place, who guide us by their example of how to get it right. We search for what has been called an, quote, ego ideal, who best personifies our own highest intentions. Whether or not his admiration for despots derives from an underlying delusional disorder, grandiose and paranoid in nature, Trump is drawn to leaders who already fit his fundamental personality makeup. While anticipating the presidency, he looked for role models for how to preside, what that would look like, which leaders performed in ways that were inspiring. For Obama, it was Kennedy, Reagan, Dr. King, and Mandela. Bill Clinton turned to JFK, and Hillary looked to Eleanor Roosevelt. George W. Bush modeled his leadership after Jesus and Winston Churchill. For Trump, it was Hussein, Jong-un, Assad, and Putin. Those guys know how to run a tight ship. Once elected, certainly Trump, many argued, would moderate his words and actions in a so-called soft pivot. When a person is character disordered or worse, especially one who always blames others, never apologizes or displays accountability, and who never for an instant believes there is anything wrong with himself, the only possibility for change is for him to become worse, not better. In fact, all Trump's despicable traits have been frighteningly exacerbated by his ascension to the presidency. He has tried to become more of the tyrant he wants to be, not less. And since becoming president, what has Trump's attitude been toward brutal dictators? He has congratulated President Rodrigo Duterte of the Philippines for dealing with his country's drug problems in the, quote, right way, with a vigilante slaughter of nearly 10,000 people merely suspected of using or dealing drugs. In April, Trump invited him to the White House, though Duterte has not yet come. He has expressed support and approval to President Recep Erdogan of Turkey, another invitee to the White House, who has engaged in a harsh, systematic purge of all opposition over the past year while arrogating dictatorial powers to himself alone over what had previously been a democratically elected government. During his visit to Washington, Erdogan unleashed his bodyguard thugs to savagely repel peaceful protesters in front of the Turkish embassy. Despite their clashes and nuclear saber rattling, Trump has referred to Kim Jong-un as a, quote, smart cookie, one whom he continues to admire for the insanely harsh methods Kim has used to maintain control over North Korea since his father's death. Bizarrely, Kim, too, has been invited to the White House. Ditto President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who has viciously ruled Egypt with an iron fist since taking office in 2013. By contrast, shortly after his inauguration, Trump insulted Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull of Australia in a phone call, reportedly slamming the phone down, and he childishly refused to shake the hand of German Chancellor Angela Merkel, with live television cameras broadcasting the world over during her April visit to the White House. Australia and Germany have long been among our closest allies. Trump also stunningly shoved aside, while all the world watched, the Prime Minister of Montenegro, Dusko Markovic, in his haste to get to the front row for a group photo op during a G20 conference. Far beyond his staggering affinity for monstrous tyrants, Trump, since coming to office, has railed against a critical free press, vilified millions of marching protesters as paid professionals, denigrated our federal appeals courts for thwarting his Muslim travel ban as unconstitutional, abruptly fired 46 state attorneys general, and shockingly fired FBI Director James Comey for what Trump brazenly admitted was Comey's ongoing investigation of potential collusion between Russia and the 2016 Trump campaign. The day following Comey's abrupt departure, despite the mind-boggling optics, Trump welcomed Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov to the White House and allowed Russian film crews into the meeting while blocking American press and photographers. Days later, reports circulated that DT had shared, without permission, highly classified information given to the United States by Israel, possibly leading to the deaths of embedded Israeli spies. Trump reportedly did so in an impulsive and boastful way, seeming to try to impress the Russians. The event has rattled our allies, who now feel they cannot trust the United States with intelligence, and thus exposed and endangered the intelligence sources who provided the information. In addition, he reportedly bragged to the Russians about firing FBI Director Comey, whom he called a, quote, nut job, and expressed relief that the Russia-Trump campaign collusion investigation was over. It is not. His honeymoon with Putin has already cooled, but what is Trump capable of when the bromance ends? Given his mental instability, his thirst for adulation is rivaled only by his obsession for vengeance, even for the tiniest of slights. What happens when he discovers that Putin has been playing him like a fiddle, or when Putin potentially humiliates him on the world stage? As Trump stated dozens of times during the primary, quote, as long as they're nice to me, I'll be nice to them. But if they get nasty and hit me, I'll hit back much, much harder. Checks and balances? Hey, nobody writes checks anymore. And you can't see his balances until the IRS audit is completed. The Constitution? Believe me, those are rules, and rules are meant to be broken. Besides, rules are for losers, and Trump's a winner. He's a winner. Like the despots he idolizes, Trump intends to rule, not lead, to control, not compromise. The 2016 presidential election was not about traditional Republican versus Democratic views. Quite literally, it was about apocalypse, not politics. This can't be happening. It can, and it is. Jefferson's warning has never been more relevant. Why crazy like a fox versus crazy like a crazy really matters. Trump's penchant for brutality alone would be disconcerting. Yet, given the evidence of delusional disorder, we must ask why the distinction of, quote, crazy like a fox versus, quote, crazy like a crazy even matters. Although there are several areas in which Trump's particular version of personality disorder is vital to understand, none is more compelling or terrifying than his control of the nuclear codes. Surpassing the devastation of climate, healthcare, education, diplomacy, social services, freedom of speech, and liberty and justice for all, nothing is more incomprehensible than the now plausible prospect of all-out nuclear war. For all but the few remaining survivors who witnessed the atomic bombing of Japan and its aftermath, we simply have nothing in our own experience to imagine instantaneous annihilation. Quite literally, we are here 1 second and vaporized the next, along with everyone and everything. Because of this very real existential threat, it is absolutely urgent that we comprehend the titanic differences between a president who is merely crazy like a fox, that is, shrewd, calculating, and convinced that the truth is spoken only when it happens to coincide with his purposes, versus what I have termed crazy like a crazy, possessing well-hidden, core, grandiose, and paranoid delusions that are disconnected from factual reality. To illustrate the differences, let's look at two actual episodes from recent American history and consider how Trump might act faced with similar circumstances. The 3 a.m. call, President Carter. In 1979, near the end of Jimmy Carter's presidency, the nightmare phone call came at 3 a.m., awakening Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, with the news that 250 nuclear Soviet missiles were bearing down on America. Knowing that he still had 5 or 6 minutes to act and that mistakes could cause false alarms, Brzezinski directed an aide to find further verification. The aide immediately called back, this time to report that 2,500 nuclear missiles were incoming. As Brzezinski prepared to call President Carter to advise a full-fledged counterattack, he elected not to wake his sleeping wife, reasoning that she would be dead in a matter of minutes. As he was reaching to phone the president, a third call came in announcing that the report of the incoming missiles was a false alarm caused by a computer glitch. It is extremely disconcerting to note that false alarms and accidents are by no means a rare occurrence. The Cuban Missile Crisis, President Kennedy. Unlike the nightmarish false alarm of 1979, lasting 5 minutes, which few were aware of, the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962 lasted 13 white-knuckle days, played out before the entire world in a series of very real, terrifying actions and reactions between America and the USSR. At several junctures, the world was within an eyelash of all-out nuclear holocaust. The gist of the crisis entailed Russia's intentions to place nuclear missiles in Cuba in response to the United States having deployed nuclear sites close to Russia's borders in Turkey and Italy. The Joint Chiefs of Staff unanimously pressured President John F. Kennedy to preemptively attack Cuban missile sites already in place, with the rationale that Russia would not back down and not counterattack, especially given its much smaller nuclear capability. Fortunately, JFK had the equanimity to hold off and follow the advice of his civilian advisors, notably RFK and Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. Interviewed many years later, McNamara described leaving the White House late in the crisis. Marveling at a beautiful sunset, he thought that it might well be the last any of us would ever see. Government families in D.C., as well as those from cities and towns everywhere, were fleeing to remote regions in the hope of surviving a nuclear attack. The standoff climaxed when Russia agreed to remove the existing missile sites from Cuba and to build no new ones in exchange for the United States' public commitment never to invade Cuba. Saving face, JFK also secretly agreed to remove the missiles from Turkey and Italy. The world exhaled. The crazy like a fox characterization of DT needs little explanation. The phrase describes someone who may appear crazy, for example, erratic, irrational, impulsive, on the surface, but whose seemingly crazy external behavior is a cleverly designed strategy to mislead, distract, and deceive others into responding in precisely the manner that is secretly desired. This is indeed one aspect of Trump's behavior. Someone who is crazy like a fox during that given moment is actually the exact opposite of crazy. When insisting that the fake media created the feud between him and the intelligence community, such a person would fail a reliable lie detector test because he would know he was lying. The most jarring evidence yet of Trump's crazy like a crazy delusional disorder came with his early morning tweets, subsequently deleted, in March, that his Trump Tower phones had been wiretapped by a, quote, bad or sick Obama. The tweets included insane comparisons to Watergate and McCarthyism. Trump's actions immediately generated bipartisan criticism, and there was a complete lack of evidence from anyone, anywhere, that he had been targeted for surveillance. The suspicion that one is being wiretapped is an absolutely classic expression of paranoid delusions. When insisting that the fake media created the feud between him and the intelligence community, DT would unequivocally have passed a lie detector test because he believed the delusion was actually true. Crazy like a fox characterizes a person whose apparent external rationality masks underlying irrational thinking. Crazy like a crazy characterizes a person whose apparent external rationality masks underlying irrational thinking. Returning to our historical examples of nuclear emergencies, is there anyone who could possibly believe that Trump would have shown Brzezinski's grace under pressure had he himself received that 3 a.m. phone call? If indeed Trump harbors grandiose and paranoid delusions for which there is mounting evidence, he would have launched missiles faster than he fires off paranoid tweets on a Saturday morning. Given the 13 days of excruciating tension during the very real nuclear threat of the Cuban Missile Crisis, is there anyone who possibly believes that Trump could have demonstrated JFK's composure, wisdom, and judgment, especially in the face of unanimous pressure from his military advisors? If Trump were indeed merely crazy like a fox, it would still be a huge stretch, but increasingly that appears not to be the case.
Michael J. Tanzi, Ph.D., www.drmichaeljtanzi.com, is a Chicago-based clinical psychologist, author, and teacher. He is a graduate of Harvard University, AB 1972 in personality theory, and Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, PhD 1978 in clinical psychology. In addition to his full-time practice, he was an assistant professor teaching and supervising students, interns, residents, and postdoctoral fellows. He has been in private practice for more than 35 years, working with adults, adolescents, and couples. Along with a co-authored book on empathy and the therapeutic process, he has written numerous professional journal articles, as well as 25 blogs for the Huffington Post.
Cognitive Impairment, Dementia, and POTUS. David M. Rice, M.D. Obviously, it is difficult to conceive of a more stressful, demanding job than being POTUS. Leaving aside all the serious, critical, and snarky questions we hear regarding presidential vacations, golf outings, and so on, the office demands the ability to be emotionally and cognitively alert and intact, and fully on duty at a moment's notice 24/7. Potentially, the lives and well-being of millions of people are at stake in any number of the presidential decisions required to be developed over time with appropriate advice and counseling, or within minutes without any prior notice regarding the specific details or options. It goes without saying that the position of POTUS inherently requires an almost inhuman degree of cognitive clarity at all times, regardless of the personal situation or circumstances of the man or woman holding the office. It is not surprising that the idea of a dual presidency, at least some division of tasks, has been considered at different times, including briefly during the last election cycle. Although implementation of the idea has never seemed practically or politically possible. In general, the populace values exuberance, energy, and experience as essential qualities in a POTUS. Some would say, with each cycle, which traits are considered of primary importance at different times. Historically, longings for an experienced leader and the seeking of a paternal, even grandfatherly presidential persona and political presence have often yielded male candidates who are in their senior years, with Donald Trump being the oldest person to be sworn in as POTUS. With age comes experience, and, it is hoped, wisdom, but also, medically, concerns regarding cognitive decline. It is now recognized that while some neurological functioning has peak efficiency during early adult years, as in physical reaction time, in general, cognitive functioning remains remarkably intact until quite late in the life cycle, with minor deterioration during the 70s and a more measurable decline after age 80. But such decline certainly is not universal, of the healthy older adult. Thus, the key issue to be addressed is not age-related cognitive decline, but illness-related cognitive decline and decline related to other non-age-dependent physiological factors, the use of prescribed medications, a history of past or present substance abuse, a history of injury to the head, for example. In general, older persons are more likely to be using multiple prescribed medications than younger persons, and many medications may have a subtle negative impact upon cognition, but that is not an age-related issue in and of itself. Therefore, concerns regarding the cognitive abilities of a POTUS can be divided into five general areas. 1. Innate baseline intellectual cognitive skills and ability. 2. Impairment due to an ongoing neurological deterioration, Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementia. 3. Impairment caused by acute illness, especially in older individuals. Even a urinary tract infection can negatively impact cognition. 4. Toxic effects of prescribed medications or use of illicit substances. And 5. Cumulative effects of head trauma and or use of licit or illicit toxic agents, an issue that has received much more attention clinically and publicly vis-a-vis sports-related concussion injury. Baseline intellectual and cognitive skills. The current political system sets no intellectual or cognitive standards or physical medical well-being standards for someone to become POTUS. Clearly, this is a vulnerability. Equally as clearly, the question of where any line should be drawn regarding health or, in particular, intellectual and cognitive prowess, as well as how and by whom those parameters would be measured, in my opinion, make it practically unlikely that any such standards will ever be implemented. In essence, we rely upon the candidates to voluntarily divulge their medical history, which Trump did not do with any indication of clinical validity, and we rely upon the voting populace to determine if a candidate's intellectual abilities measure up. An inherently flawed system, as the populace has access only to prepackaged presentations and observations of a candidate in debates and while he or she is giving speeches, hardly an adequate database for accurately gauging intellectual ability. Based upon the limited information available, persons with professional training could provide public opinions regarding a candidate's intellect, but the database that even professionals can use remains inadequate and incomplete, and differentiation between objectivity and clinically solid opinions versus politically based propaganda is an insurmountable problem. At the current time, I view this as a problem without any solution in the near future. Impairment due to an ongoing neurological deterioration. In the vernacular, the term Alzheimer's is often used nonspecifically to refer to dementing illness, which is not clinically accurate, as deterioration of cognitive functioning can occur due to multiple different degenerative neurological disease processes. However, with regard to the issue at hand, the important question is whether a degenerative process is present, not necessarily a specific diagnosis. Other than in certain relatively uncommon acute illnesses, cognitive decline due to degenerative neurological disorders is a relatively slow process that can begin insidiously. As just noted, but not commonly appreciated, absent other factors, normal aging is a very infrequent cause of significant cognitive impairment prior to true old age, as in above 80 years. It is not unusual for early indications of a degenerative process to be excused or minimized as age-related and not seen as particularly significant acutely, which they may not be, or recognized as implying a problematic prognosis. This is an area in which sophisticated clinicians may notice, even from public appearances and interactions, that a person is exhibiting indications suggestive of an early stage of a dementing process. Without a full medical history and without formal testing, no diagnosis can be provided based upon such observation, but certainly a trained observer can identify cause for concern and suggest the prudence of obtaining a formal evaluation. However, it is obviously problematic for many reasons to rely upon unsolicited opinions from practitioners whose level of experience, objectivity, and ulterior motivations may be suspect, legitimately or defensively, manipulatively. This is, in fact, what has occurred regarding the candidacy and election of Donald Trump. Multiple experts have voiced concern, some referring to an inherent duty to warn. Multiple differing opinions have been expressed, ranging from denial of any evidence necessitating concern to suggestions of the need for a formal evaluation to speculation about provision of and even rumor of specific diagnoses. Objectively, I personally do not see how any informed clinician would not notice a significant difference between the cognitive performance of Trump in videos from 15 years ago to his current presentation. Objectively, I personally do not see how any informed clinician cannot conclude that there is reason for concern and/or a formal evaluation. Yet, at the same time, the videos from the past were produced under very different situations, vis-a-vis planning, scripting, stress, and in some cases editing, and it has been my stance that the promulgation of anything beyond a general warning, along with education regarding the differential diagnoses, for example, possible causes for the apparent change, is not clinically supported without additional data, as well as being ethically questionable. Thus, in my opinion, it has been appropriate and, in fact, prudent for clinicians to speak out regarding their concerns of possible neurological deterioration, but But the public discussion has been so muddled that serious and legitimate concerns voiced have had no practical impact. Although the presidency of Donald Trump is still young and, in the view of many, including me, quite problematic, with very high and dangerous risks present, in essence, we have probably already dodged a bullet at least once. During the first 1984 debate between Ronald Reagan and Walter Mondale, Reagan obviously experienced a moment of disorganization. A brief lapse can happen to anyone under stress and need not be assumed to indicate the presence of pathology. For example, Rick Perry's forgetting the third department he wished to disband during the 2012 primary debate. In retrospect, Reagan's becoming lost appeared more significant. There were already public concerns regarding his medical status, and it was later reported that friends and family were well aware that a degenerative disease was progressing. Yet, there was no significant expression of public concern by clinicians, and the issue was, out of, in my opinion, misplaced politeness, not seriously raised within the political discourse. Perhaps if clinicians had spoken up, there could have been a reasonable call for appropriate medical records or evaluation. It might have backfired, and the election could have been determined on the spot, but personally, I always wonder what might have happened if, in the second debate, in a sincere and diplomatic manner, Mondale had raised the question to Reagan, "Sir, the last time we met, you appeared to have a moment of significant confusion. What would the consequences be if that occurred during a national emergency?" It is conceivable that Reagan could have deftly deflected the question, and Mondale would have been pilloried, his campaign essentially ended. Yet it is also conceivable that if Reagan had some awareness of his difficulties, the question could have led to his becoming acutely disturbed and discombobulated, perhaps revealing his vulnerability and swinging the election in the other direction. We will never know. And thankfully, whatever neurological impairment Reagan suffered while in office did not, to anyone's knowledge, ever lead to any inappropriate action, behavior, or decision. Nonetheless, that is not a risk the country should look forward to taking again. While neurological degenerative disease can occur even at relatively young ages, this is quite uncommon, and perhaps the wisest course would be for there to be a legal imperative for candidates above a certain age to undergo neuropsychological testing to rule out the process of a progressive illness. It would still be problematic to determine exactly what tests should be administered, who should administer them, and where a cutoff for eligibility, determination of fitness to serve, should be set. It is conceivable that a bipartisan effort based upon clinical knowledge could at least set standards for disqualifying a candidate for whom there is objective medical evidence of a progressive disorder. Short of such a procedure, in my opinion, qualified professionals should not hesitate to carefully, judiciously express any concerns they may have, providing as much educative information as possible, while appreciating that, practically, the situation will remain confusing and controversial to a large segment of the population, and that pernicious manipulation by unscrupulous clinicians cannot be avoided. Impairment caused by acute illness and toxic effects of prescribed medications or illicit substances. Any number of medical conditions can negatively impact cognition in any person, regardless of age, although, in general, as age progresses, vulnerability to cognitive impairment increases. Similarly, many medications very legitimately and appropriately prescribed for medical purposes can result in side effects ranging from mild word-finding difficulties, not uncommon with anticholinergic agents, to more significant cognitive slippage or confusion, and even overt delirium. It goes without saying that those risks are higher with use of specific psychotropic medications and, of course, illicit drugs or alcohol. Acute side effects are very often reversible, while some agents, definitely alcohol, other illicit drugs, controversially some rather common medications, generally considered benign, may result in irreversible cognitive problems. However, practically, Identifying these issues in a candidate does not appear to be nearly as problematic as addressing the question of a degenerative process. Simply by the release of objective and clinically sound medical records, including a toxicological screen and consideration of potential medication side effects, with formal neuropsychological testing performed if indicated by the clinical history and findings, issues of acutely impaired cognitive functioning can be identified and often remedied, or at least such as in the possibility of illicit drug use or mild insignificant side effects, for instance, some simple word-finding difficulties due to use of antihypertensives, be made public. If any such findings cannot be remedied, then the situation would essentially fall into Section 2, as described above. Cumulative effects of head trauma and/or use of licit or illicit toxic agents. It is now recognized and generally accepted that a history of even mild head trauma, especially if there have been multiple events, as well as past use of licit or illicit psychoactive agents, can produce acute cognitive impairment that lasts longer than was previously thought and can trigger an ongoing cognitive deterioration, the specific mechanism of which is not yet well understood. Increasing evidence is being obtained from those who participated in contact sports and even relatively non-contact sports that involve use of the head, as in soccer, as well as victims of domestic violence or abuse that involved blows to the head, can suffer from increasing cognitive difficulties as they age, even years after the injury's exposure occurred, and even if acute symptomatology did not seem particularly severe. While the medical details regarding CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, remain controversial and under investigation, it cannot be denied that many persons with a history of head trauma or substance abuse suffer from cognitive decline that is not related to Alzheimer's syndrome or other typical degenerative neurological disorders. However, determining the presence and severity of any such decline and establishing a prognosis is somewhat more complicated than determining the presence or absence of a well-established disease process. Thus, this is not an issue that is practically different than described in 2 above, but it is an area of a person's medical history that, to this day, often remains overlooked and deserves appropriate consideration and evaluation within any review of a candidate's medical history. Summary. No reasonable person would want someone with compromised cognitive intellectual functioning to serve as POTUS. However, to date, there is no process or procedure beyond voluntary release of medical records that provides the public with any reliable knowledge regarding whether a candidate for the office of POTUS suffers from cognitive impairment or is at high risk for cognitive degeneration. Others have discussed the very problematic aspects of the candidacy of Donald Trump with regard to acute psychiatric illness and chronic catarrhological dysfunction pathology, especially in a person for whom questions of acute or chronic psychiatric issues come into play, issues that inherently impact cognition, judgment, decision-making, etc. Additional or superimposed neurologically based cognitive impairment becomes even more critical. Yet, absent the specific circumstances of the Trump candidacy election, the candidate selection and electoral processes do not in any manner take into account the medical and neurological knowledge gained since the time of the Founding Fathers, knowledge that continues to expand and will continue to expand with ever-increasing sophistication and understanding. Nevertheless, applying clinical medical knowledge to a political process is practically complex and daunting with regard to issues of objectivity, the setting of parameters, for example, for qualification, disqualification, and the avoidance of ill-informed and/or malicious manipulation. The process of taking into account a candidate's cognitive abilities and status is fraught with danger. Those who speak out must do so carefully, not without risk, and to a populace that should be reasonably skeptical. This is indeed a very slippery slope. However, it is far wiser to attempt to maintain an appropriate balance upon that slope than to totally ignore its presence and remain in total denial regarding the potential risks to the country and the world.
David M. Reese, M.D., attended Northwestern University, Chemical Biomedical Engineering Medical School, and has maintained a private psychiatric practice in California since 1982. Dr. Reese has evaluated, treated more than 12,000 people, has served as interim medical director of Providence Hospital, Massachusetts, and has recently been associated with the Brattleboro Retreat, Vermont. He is a California qualified medical examiner and a member of professional organizations, including the Society for the Exploration of Psychotherapeutic Integration, the Sports Lawyers Association, and the International Psychohistory Association. Dr. Reese has appeared in all media formats addressing clinical issues and psychological aspects of social and political phenomena.
Donald J. Trump, alleged incapacitated person. Mental Incapacity, the Electoral College, and the 25th Amendment, by James A. Herb, Esquire. Donald J. Trump became an alleged incapacitated person on October 4, 2016, when I filed a petition to determine his mental incapacity in the Palm Beach County Circuit Court. I claim legal standing to commence such a proceeding as an adult and a resident of Florida, and based on the fact that Trump's apparent lack of mental capacity to function could impact me and possibly the whole world, in addition to him. Part 1. Before the election. I have a BA and MA in political science, and I've always been a political junkie of sorts. I followed the televised Watergate hearings leading up to President Nixon's resignation in 1974. I taught a course in the Constitution and politics after I received my law degree. I followed the impeachment proceedings of President Clinton. I lived through every day of Bush v. Gore. But nothing prepared me for Trump's presidential campaign, which started with a ride down an escalator. Perhaps the symbolism was prophetic. Instead of ascending to the heights, he was descending to the depths and taking us all with him. How low could an escalator go? I never imagined that Trump's style of campaigning could thrive in our society. Like many, I assumed that Trump would not get the Republican nomination for president. Then, in July 2016, he did. I started to agonize over the possibility of a Trump presidency. It was true, of course, that two hurdles still stood between Trump's nomination and what I believed might be the apocalypse. One was a general election to take place on November 8, 2016. The second, should Trump win, was the voting of the Electoral College to take place on December 19, 2016. Was there anything that I, a simple probate attorney, an ordinary citizen, could do? I started to review the public record regarding things Trump had said and done. I compiled a list of 200 items that I believe reflected his mental disability to discharge the duties of a president. The list could have been substantially larger, but I stopped at 200. There was a lot of commentary on the internet about Trump's mental state. There were also internet petitions seeking a determination by someone that Trump lacked the mental capacity to be president. No one suggested a court proceeding. I reviewed the Goldwater Rule, discussed in more detail in Part 2 of this book, and its apparent prohibition of certain mental health professionals from diagnosing the mental health of a public official from afar. The irony of this is that I, not a mental health professional, and perhaps less formally trained to make such a diagnosis, in no way come under the Goldwater Rule prohibition. To the contrary, part of my job as a guardianship attorney is to come to a preliminary conclusion about the mental incapacity of a person before I file a petition to determine incapacity. Once, when I tuned in to watch a Trump rally on TV, he was reciting lyrics from a song titled The Snake. about a tender-hearted woman who rescues a half-frozen snake only to be fatally bitten by it once it revived. The snake says, "You knew damn well I was a snake before you took me in." I thought Trump was speaking about himself, and the American people were the tender-hearted woman. It turned out he was speaking about immigrants as being vicious snakes. This story is similar to other animal fables, perhaps best illustrated by the story of the scorpion and the frog, which is told in various forms. In one telling, a scorpion asks a frog to carry him on his back in a swim across the pond. The frog is reluctant, fearful of the scorpion's sting. The scorpion argues that he obviously won't sting the frog, because if he does, they will both drown. So they start crossing the pond, and midway across, the scorpion stings the frog. Just before they sink below the surface of the water, the frog asks the scorpion why he has stung him. The scorpion replies, "I can't control my nature." I was concerned that we might end up with a scorpion king in the White House, someone who was unable to control a dangerous part of his nature. Having practiced guardianship law for almost 40 years, I believe that it might be appropriate to start an incapacity proceeding in Palm Beach County, where Trump maintains a residence at Mar-a-Lago, and ultimately to have a three-person examining committee appointed to interview Trump and file reports as to whether he lacked the mental capacity to be president. While I have handled many incapacity proceedings, I would be dealing with someone who was clearly not a normal, abnormal person. If the court had proceeded and ultimately determined that Trump was incapacitated, it could not have prevented him from running because Trump met the age and other eligibility requirements to be president as set forth in the Constitution. But such a determination would have been an appropriate consideration for the electorate in going to the polls and deciding for whom to vote. My petition was ready to go in mid-August 2016, but instead of filing it, I decided to speak to various people about it. These people were not part of any presidential campaign and were not political party officials. I spoke to lawyers, non-lawyers, and retired judges. I spoke to Republicans, Democrats, and Independents. To me, it wasn't an issue of partisan politics. It was an issue of the survival of our democracy. I also thought long and hard about proceeding. Did I wish to antagonize someone who might become president? Did I want to antagonize someone so vindictive, so litigious? Might I be sued for defamation? Might my life, as I knew it, end? I decided that the issue was so extremely important to everyone in our country, and possibly to everyone in the world, that I felt compelled to file the petition to determine incapacity as a patriotic duty. I filed the petition a little more than a month before the November 8, 2016 election. It alleged that Trump was, or might be, incapacitated to seek or retain employment based on the following factual information. First, that his actions or statements appeared to support a diagnosis of histrionic personality disorder, which is DSM-5-301.50, meeting diagnostic criteria 1 through 8. And second, that his actions or statements appeared to support a diagnosis of narcissistic personality disorder, DSM-5-301.81, meeting diagnostic criteria 1 through 9. I attached my list of 200 supporting statements made by Trump during the course of his campaign. The first judge assigned to the case recused herself. The second assigned judge ordered that I explain why my petition ought not be dismissed and to address whether a state court could restrict Trump from seeking the presidency, given that Trump met the sole eligibility requirements to be president as set forth in Article 2, Section 1, Clause 5 of the Constitution, which is being at least 35 years of age, a U.S. resident for 14 years, and a natural-born citizen. The day before the election, the court dismissed my incapacity proceeding. Part 2. After Election Day, the Electoral College. After Election Day, and before the date for the Electoral College to meet and vote, I asked that the court reconsider its decision, arguing that the issue of whether Trump was mentally incapacitated was not moot. Given that the president is selected by the members of the Electoral College and not by a direct vote of the electorate, perhaps the Electoral College could save us. I argued that it was the original intent of the framers of the Constitution, as explained in Alexander Hamilton's Federalist No. 68, March 12, 1788, that the electors were to provide wisdom and judgment beyond that held by the general public in making the selection of the president. The president is to be selected by the sense of the people, operating through electors selected by the people for that particular purpose. The election of the president should be made by men most capable of analyzing the qualities adapted to the station and acting under circumstances favorable to deliberation and to a judicious combination of all the reasons and inducements which were proper to govern their choice. Hamilton also wrote, "A small number of persons selected by their fellow citizens from the general mass will be most likely to possess the information and discernment requisite to so complicated an investigation." The process of election through electors affords a moral certainty that the office of president will seldom fall to the lot of any man who is not in an eminent degree endowed with the requisite qualifications. I pointed out that Supreme Court Justice Robert H. Jackson, who was also the architect of the international war crime trials of Nazi leaders, as well as the lead American prosecutor at Nuremberg, said that the plan originally contemplated was that electors would be free agents to exercise an independent and nonpartisan judgment as to the men best qualified for the nation's highest office. Justice Jackson went on, "This arrangement miscarried. Electors, although often personally eminent, independent, and respectable, officially became voluntary party lackeys and intellectual non-entities to whose memory we might justly paraphrase this tuneful satire. They always voted at their party's call and never thought of thinking for themselves at all." As an institution, the Electoral College suffered atrophy almost indistinguishable from rigor mortis, Justice Robert Jackson quoted from Ray v. Blair. I added that the framers intended electors to be persons of superior discernment, virtue, and information, who would select the president according to their own will and without reference to the immediate wishes of the people, again quoting Ray v. Blair, Justice Jackson dissenting. Electors constitutionally remain free to cast their ballots for any person they wish, and occasionally they have done so. While a state court determination that Trump lacked mental capacity to be president would not automatically have disqualified him from serving, such a determination would have been vital information for members of the Electoral College to have. Having as much relevant information as possible is a prescription from the founders to the members of the Electoral College, necessary for members to perform their function properly. In my case, the court did not change its holding. Trump was selected by the Electoral College on December 19, 2016, and was inaugurated on January 20, 2017. Part 3. After Inauguration, the 25th Amendment. I saw no presidential pivot by Trump in his first 10 days in office, so on January 30, 2017, I filed a second petition to determine incapacity. In those first 10 days, Trump espoused at least two delusional beliefs. One was as to the size of the crowd at his inauguration. A second was that Secretary Clinton had won the popular vote in the presidential election only because between 3 million and 5 million illegal votes had been cast. Also in those first 10 days, Trump issued various executive orders that demonstrated his mental inability to comprehend the following: what is and what is not legal, such as the immigration ban; what it can and cannot do without getting funding approval from Congress, such as building a border wall with Mexico, and what is and is not in the best interest of our country's security. Steve Bannon is in. Certain cabinet-level officers are out. Trump alienated Mexico, alienated nations across the world with his immigration ban, displayed an inability to vet issues and actions with appropriate parts of the U.S. government before taking action, and displayed a total inability to anticipate or even consider the impact of his statements and actions. My petition asserted that in order for him to continue as president, he needed to have the mental capacity to, number one, separate fact from fiction, two, think through an issue or matter before speaking or taking action, three, be able and willing to learn about issues, four, apply coherent decision-making to facts, five, communicate coherently, six, be consistent without vacillating or flip-flopping with statements he makes, seven, comprehend likely results from saying certain things or taking certain actions, eight, differentiate between acceptable decisions and horrendous decisions, nine, be willing to understand, protect, and defend the U.S. Constitution, including its provisions that relate to the functioning of the executive branch and the rights of the citizens under the Bill of Rights. 10. Keep himself from committing high crimes and misdemeanors, as that term appears in the U.S. Constitution, Article 2, Section 4, regarding impeachment. 11. Make agreements and keep those agreements. 12. Learn about and conduct foreign policy on behalf of the United States. 13. Deal reasonably and effectively with other people. 14. Not be delusional. 15. Understand basic democratic principles, including the importance of a free and fair election and the importance of not claiming that it is rigged before it has occurred, the undemocratic nature of intending to jail his election rival, and the danger of propounding multiple conspiracy theories against him. And 16, be stable in his thoughts and speech. I asserted that the statements of Trump support a determination that he suffers from narcissistic personality disorder, which would make him mentally incapable of continuing as president, and that he, number one, has a grandiose sense of self-importance, two, is preoccupied with fantasies of unlimited success, power, or brilliance. Three, believes that he is special and unique. Four, requires excessive admiration. Five, has a sense of entitlement, that is, has unreasonable expectations of especially favorable treatment or automatic compliance with his expectations. Six, is interpersonally exploitive, that is, takes advantage of others to achieve his own ends. 7. Lacks empathy, being unwilling or unable to recognize or identify with feelings and needs of others. And 8. Shows arrogant, haughty behaviors or attitudes. I asserted that the statements of Trump support a determination that he suffers from histrionic personality disorder, which would make him mentally incapable of continuing as president, and that he, number one, has had interactions with others that are often characterized by inappropriate, sexually seductive, or provocative behavior. Two, displays rapidly shifting and shallow expressions of emotions. Three, has a style of speech that is excessively impressionistic and lacking in detail. Four, shows self-dramatization and exaggerated expression of emotions, and five, is suggestible, that is, easily influenced by others or by circumstances. I asserted that Trump appears to suffer from delusional beliefs, which would make him incapable of continuing as president. Citing various of the more than 200 troubling statements made by him during the election campaign, I asserted that the U.S. Constitution does have provisions that deal with the inability of a president, once in office, to discharge the powers and duties of that office, being Sections 3 and 4 of the 25th Amendment. Sections 3 and 4 of the 25th Amendment state, Section 3, whenever the President transmits to the President pro tem of the Senate and the Speaker of the House of Representatives his written declaration that he is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office, and until he transmits to them a written declaration to the contrary, such powers and duties shall be discharged by the Vice President as Acting President. Section 4. Whenever the Vice President and a majority of either the principal officers of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may by law